was only inches from its red, viciously stupid eyes. Its legs, each as thick as my wrist, slipped back and forth across the square bonnet. Amanda screamed ceaselessly like a fire bell. "Woman, shut your head," Mrs. Repler told her. The spider gave up. It could not smell us, ergo we were no longer there. It strutted back into the mist on its unsettling number of legs, became a phantasm, and then was gone. I looked out the window to make sure it was gone, and then opened the door. "What are you doing?" Amanda screamed, but I knew what I was doing. I like to think Ollie would have done exactly the same thing. I half-stepped, half-leaned out, and got the gun. Something came rapidly toward me, but I never saw it. I pulled back in and slammed the door shut. Amanda began to sob. Mrs. Repler put an arm around her and comforted her briskly. Billy said, "Are we going home, Daddy?" "Big Bill, we're gonna try." "Okay," he said quietly. I checked the gun and then put it into the glove compartment. Ollie had reloaded it after the expedition to the drugstore. The rest of the shells had disappeared with him, but that was all right. He had fired at Mrs. Carmody. He had fired once at the clawed thing, and the gun had discharged once when it hit the ground. There were four of us in the scout, but if push came right down to shove, I'd find some other way out for myself. I had a terrible moment when I couldn't find my key ring. I checked all my pockets, came up empty, and then checked them all again, forcing myself to go slowly and calmly. They were in my jeans pocket. They had gotten down under the coins, as keys sometimes will. The scout started easily. At the confident roar of the engine, Amanda burst into fresh tears. I sat there, letting it idle, waiting to see what was going to be drawn by the sound of the engine or the smell of the exhaust. 5 minutes, the longest 5 of my life, drifted by. Nothing happened.
"Are we going to sit here or are we going to go?" Mrs. Repler asked at last.
"Go," I said. I backed out of the slot and put on the low beams. Some urge, probably a base one, made me cruise past the Federal Market as close as I could get. The scout's right bumper bunted the trash barrel to one side. It was impossible to see in except through the loopholes. All those fertilizer and lawn food bags made the place look as if it were in the throes of some mad garden sale. But at each loophole, there were 2 or 3 pale faces staring out at us. Then I swung to the left, and the mist closed impenetrably behind us. And what has become of those people, I do not know. I drove back down Kansas Road at 5 miles an hour, feeling my way. Even with the scout's headlights and running lights on, it was impossible to see more than 7 or 10 feet ahead. The earth had been through some terrible contortion. Miller had been right about that. In places the road was merely cracked, but in others the ground itself seemed to have caved in, tilting up great slabs of paving. I was able to get over with the help of the 4-wheel drive, thank God for that. But I was terribly afraid that we would soon come to an obstacle that even the 4-wheel drive couldn't get us over. It took me 40 minutes to make a drive that usually only took 7 or 8. At last, the sign that marked our private road loomed out of the mist. Billy, roused at 4:15, had fallen solidly asleep inside this car that he knew so well it must have seemed like home to him. Amanda looked at the road nervously.
"Are you really going down there?"
"I'm going to try," I said. But it was impossible. The storm that had whipped through had loosened a lot of trees, and that weird twisting drop had finished the job of tumbling them. I was able to crunch over the first two. They were fairly small. Then I came to a hoary old pine lying across the road like an outlaw's barricade. It was still almost 1/4 mile to the house. Billy slept on beside me, and I put the scout in park, put my hands over my eyes, and tried to think what to do next. Now, as I sit in the Howard Johnson's near exit 3 of the main turnpike, writing all of this down on Hojo's stationery, I suspect that Mrs. Repler, that tough and capable old broad,
could have laid out the essential futility of the situation in a few quick strokes, but she had the kindness to let me think it through for myself. I couldn't get out. I couldn't leave them. I couldn't even kid myself that all the horror movie monsters were back at the Federal. When I cracked the window, I could hear them in the woods, crashing and blundering around on the steep fall of land they call the ledges around these parts. The moisture drip, drip, dripped from the overhanging leaves. Overhead, the mist darkened momentarily as some nightmarish and half-seen living kite overflew us. I tried to tell myself, then and now, that if she was very quick, if she buttoned up the house with herself inside, that she had enough food for 10 days to 2 weeks. It only works a little bit. What keeps getting in the way is my last memory of her, wearing her floppy sun hat and gardening gloves on her way to our little vegetable patch with the mist rolling inexorably across the lake behind her. It is Billy I have to think about now. Billy, I tell myself. Big Bill. Big Bill. I should write it maybe 100 times on this sheet of paper like a child condemned to write, "I will not throw spitballs in school," as the sunny 3 o'clock stillness spills through the windows and the teacher corrects homework papers at her desk and the only sound is her pen, while somewhere, far away, kids pick up teams for scratch baseball. Anyway, at last I did the only thing I could do. I reversed the scout carefully back to Kansas Road. Then I cried. Amanda touched my shoulder timidly. "David, I'm so sorry," she said. "Yeah," I said, trying to stop the tears and not having much luck. "Yeah, so am I." I drove to Route 302 and turned left toward Portland. This road was also cracked and blasted in places, but was, on the whole, more passable than Kansas Road had been. I was worried about the bridges. The face of Maine is cut with running water, and there are bridges everywhere, big and small. But the Naples Causeway was intact, and from there it was plain, if slow, sailing all the way to Portland. The mist held thick. Once I had to stop, thinking that trees were lying across the road. Then the trees began to move and undulate, and I understood they were more tentacles. I stopped, and after a while they drew back. Once a great green thing, with an iridescent green body and long transparent wings, landed on the hood. It looked like a grossly misshapen dragonfly. It hovered there for a moment, then took wing again and was gone. Billy woke up about 2 hours after we had left Kansas Road behind and asked if we had gotten Mommy yet. I told him I hadn't been able to get down our road because of the fallen trees. "Is she all right, Dad?" "Billy, I don't know, but we'll come back and see." He didn't cry. He dozed off again instead. I would have rather had his tears. He was sleeping too damn much, and I didn't like it. I began to get a tension headache. It was driving through the fog at a steady 5 or 10 miles an hour that did it. The tension of knowing that anything might come out of it, anything at all, a washout, a land spill, or Ghidra, the three-headed monster. I think I prayed. I prayed to God that Stephanie was alive and that he wouldn't take my adultery out on her. I prayed to God to let me get Billy to safety because he had been through so much. Most people had pulled to the side of the road when the mist came, and by noon we were in North Windham. I tried the river road, but about 4 miles down, a bridge spanning a small and noisy stream had fallen into the water. I had to reverse for nearly a mile before I found a spot wide enough to turn around. We went to Portland by Route 302 after all. When we got there, I drove the cutoff to the turnpike. The neat line of toll booths guarding the access had been turned into vacant-eyed skeletons of smashed pola glass. All of them were empty. In the sliding glass doorway of one was a torn jacket with Maine Turnpike Authority patches on the sleeves. It was drenched with tacky, drying blood. We had not seen a single living person,
since leaving the Federal. Mrs. Repler said,
David, try your radio.
I slapped my forehead in frustration and anger at myself, wondering how I could have been stupid enough to forget the scout's AM/FM for so long.
Don't do that, Mrs. Repler said curtly. You can't think of everything. If you try, you will go mad and be of no use at all.
I got nothing but a shriek of static all the way across the AM band, and the FM yielded nothing but a smooth and ominous silence.
Does that mean everything's off the air?
Amanda asked. I knew what she was thinking, maybe. We were far enough south now so that we should have been picking up a selection of strong Boston stations, WRKO, WBZ, WMEX, but if Boston had gone...
It doesn't mean anything for sure, I said. That static on the AM band is pure interference. The mist is having a damping effect on radio signals, too.
Are you sure that's all it is?
Yes, I said, not sure at all. We went south. The mileposts rolled past, counting down from about 40. When we reached mile 1, we would be at the New Hampshire border. Going on the turnpike was slower. A lot of the drivers hadn't wanted to give up, and there had been rear-end collisions in several places. Several times I had to use the median strip. At about 1:20, I was beginning to feel hungry. Billy clutched my arm.
Daddy, what's that? What's that?
A shadow loomed out of the mist, staining it dark. It was as tall as a cliff, and coming right at us, I jammed on the brakes. Amanda, who had been catnapping, was thrown forward. Something came. Again, that is all I can say for sure. It may have been the fact that the mist only allowed us to glimpse things briefly, but I think it just as likely that there are certain things that your brain simply disallows. There are things of such darkness and horror, just, I suppose, as there are things of such great beauty, that they will not fit through the puny human doors of perception. It was six-legged, I know that. Its skin was slaty gray that mottled to dark brown in places. Those brown patches reminded me absurdly of the liver spots on Mrs. Carmody's hands. Its skin was deeply wrinkled and grooved, and clinging to it were scores, hundreds of those pinkish bugs with the stalk eyes. I don't know how big it actually was, but it passed directly over us. One of its gray wrinkled legs smashed down right beside my window, and Mrs. Repler said later she could not see the underside of its body, although she craned her neck up to look. She saw only two cyclopean legs going up and up into the mist like living towers until they were lost to sight. For the moment it was over the scout, I had an impression of something so big that it might have made a blue whale look the size of a trout. In other words, something so big that it defied the imagination. Then it was gone, sending a seismological series of thuds back. It left tracks in the cement of the interstate, tracks so deep I could not see the bottoms. Each single track was nearly big enough to drop the scout into. For a moment no one spoke. There was no sound but our breathing and the diminishing thud of that great thing's passage. Then Billy said,
"Was it a dinosaur, Dad? Like the bird that got into the market?"
"I don't think so. I don't think there was ever an animal that big, Billy, at least not on Earth." I thought of the Arrowhead Project and wondered again what crazy damned thing they could have been doing up there.
"Can we go on?" Amanda asked timidly. "It might come back."
Yes, and there might be more up ahead, but there was no point in saying so. We had to go somewhere. I drove on, weaving in and out between those terrible tracks until they veered off the road. That is what happened. Or nearly all. There is one final thing I'll get to in a moment, but you mustn't expect some neat conclusion. There is no... And they escaped from the mist into the good sunshine of a new day, or
When we awoke, the National Guard had finally arrived. Or even that great old standby, it was all a dream. It is, I suppose, what my father always frowningly called an Alfred Hitchcock ending, by which he meant a conclusion in ambiguity that allowed the reader or viewer to make up his own mind about how things ended. My father had nothing but contempt for such stories, saying they were cheap shots. We got to this Howard Johnson's near Exit 3 as dusk began to close in, making driving a suicidal risk. Before that, we took a chance on the bridge that spans the Saco River. It looked badly twisted out of shape, but in the mist it was impossible to tell if it was whole or not. That particular game, we won. But there's tomorrow to think of, isn't there? As I write this, it is 1:45 in the morning, July the 23rd. The storm that seemed to signal the beginning of it all was only 4 days ago. Billy is sleeping in the lobby on a mattress that I dragged out for him. Amanda and Mrs. Repler are close by. I'm writing by the light of a big Delco flashlight, and outside the pink bugs are ticking and thumping off the glass. Every now and then there is a louder thud as one of the birds takes one off. The scout has enough gas to take us maybe another 90 miles. The alternative is to try to gas up here. There is an Exxon out on the service island, and although the power is off, I believe I could siphon some up from the tank. But it means being outside. If we can get gas here or further along, we'll keep going. I have a destination in mind now, you see. It's that last thing I wanted to tell you about. I couldn't be sure. That is the thing, the damn thing. It might have been my imagination, nothing but wish fulfillment. And even if not, it is such a long chance. How many miles? How many bridges? How many things that would love to tear up my son and eat him even as he screamed in terror and agony? The chances are so good that it was nothing but a daydream that I haven't told the others. At least, not yet. In the manager's apartment, I found a large battery-operated multi-band radio. From the back of it, a flat antenna wire led out through the window. I turned it on, switched over to Bat, fiddled with the tuning dial, with the squelch knob, and still got nothing but static or dead silence. And then, at the far end of the AM band, just as I was reaching for the knob to turn it off, I thought I heard, or dreamed I heard, one single word. There was no more. I listened for an hour, but there was no more. If there was that one word, it came through some minute shift in the damping mist, an infinitesimal break that immediately closed again. One word. I've got to get some sleep. If I can sleep and not be haunted until daybreak by the faces of Ollie Weeks and Mrs. Carmody and Norm the bag boy, and by Steph's face, half-shadowed by the wide brim of her sun hat. There is a restaurant here, a typical Hojo restaurant with a dining room and a long, horseshoe-shaped lunch counter. I am going to leave these pages on the counter, and perhaps someday someone will find them and read them. One word. If I only really heard it. If only. I'm going to bed now, but first I'm going to kiss my son and whisper 2 words in his ear. Against the dreams that may come, you know? 2 words that sound a bit alike. One of them is Hartford, the other is Hope.
Here There Be Tigers. Read by Kyle Beltran.
Charles needed to go to the bathroom very badly. There was no longer any use in trying to fool himself that he could wait for recess. His bladder was screaming at him, and Miss Bird had caught him squirming. There were 3 third-grade teachers in the Acorn Street Grammar School. Miss Kinney was young and blonde and bouncy, and had a boyfriend who picked her up after school in a blue Camaro. Mrs. Trask was shaped like a Moorish pillow and did her hair in braids and laughed boomingly. And there was Miss Bird. Charles had known he would end up with Miss Bird. He had known that. It had been inevitable, because Miss Bird obviously wanted to destroy him. She did not allow children to go to the basement. The basement, Miss Bird said, was where the boilers were kept, and well-groomed ladies and gentlemen would never go down there because basements were nasty, sooty old things. Young ladies and gentlemen do not go to the basement, she said. They go to the bathroom. Charles squirmed again. Miss Bird cocked an eye at him. Charles, she said clearly, still pointing her pointer at Bolivia, do you need to go to the bathroom? Kathy Scott in the seat ahead of him giggled, wisely covering her mouth. Kenny Griffin sniggered and kicked Charles under his desk. Charles went bright red. Speak up, Charles, Miss Bird said brightly. Do you need to
urinate? She'll say urinate, she always does.
Yes, Miss Bird.
Yes, what?
I have to go to the bathroom. Miss Bird smiled. Very well, Charles. You may go to the bathroom and urinate. Is that what you need to do? Urinate?
Charles hung his head, convicted.
Very well, Charles, you may do so. And next time, kindly don't wait to be asked. General giggles. Miss Bird rapped the board with her pointer. Charles trudged up the road toward the door, 30 pairs of eyes boring into his back, and every one of those kids, including Kathy Scott, knew he was going to the bathroom to urinate. The door was at least a football field's length away. Miss Bird did not go on with the lesson, but kept her silence until he had opened the door, entered the blessedly empty hall, and shut the door again. He walked down toward the boys' bathroom. Basement, 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 if I want. Dragging his fingers along the cool tile of the wall, letting them bounce over the thumbtack-stippled bulletin board and slide lightly across the red, break glass in case of emergency, fire alarm box. Miss Bird liked it. Miss Bird liked making him have a red face. In front of Kathy Scott, who never needed to go to the basement. Was that fair? And everybody else.
Old B-I-T-C-H, he thought.
He spelled because he had decided last year God didn't say it was a sin if you spelled. He went into the boys' bathroom. It was very cool inside with a faint, not unpleasant smell of chlorine hanging pungently in the air. Now, in the middle of the morning, it was clean and deserted. Peaceful, quite pleasant. Not at all like the smoky, stinky cubicle at the Star Theater downtown. The bathroom, basement, was built like an L. The short side lined with tiny square mirrors and white porcelain wash bowls and a paper towel dispenser. Nibrak. The longer side with 2 urinals and 3 toilet cubicles. Charles went around the corner after glancing morosely at his thin, rather pallid face in one of the mirrors. The tiger was lying down at the far end, just underneath the pebbly white window. It was a large tiger, with tawny Venetian blinds and dark stripes laid across its pelt. It looked up alertly at Charles, and its green eyes narrowed. A kind of silky, purring grunt issued from its mouth. Smooth muscles flexed, and the tiger got to its feet. Its tail switched, making little chinking sounds against the porcelain side of the last urinal. The tiger looked quite hungry and very vicious. Charles hurried back the way he had come. The door seemed to take forever to wheeze pneumatically closed behind him. But when it did, he considered himself safe. This door only swung in, and he could not remember ever reading or hearing that tigers are smart enough to open doors. Charles wiped the back of his hand across his nose. His heart was thumping so hard he could hear it. He still needed to go to the basement, worse than ever. He squirmed, winced, and pressed a hand against his belly. He really had to go to the basement. If he could only be sure no one would come, he would use the girls. It was right across the hall. Charles looked at it longingly, knowing he would never dare, not in a million years. What if Kathy Scott should come, or Black Horror? What if Miss Bird should come? Perhaps he had imagined the tiger. He opened the door wide enough for one eye and peeked in. The tiger was peeking back from around the angle of the L, its eye a sparkling green. Charles fancied he could see a tiny blue fleck in that deep brilliance, as if the tiger's eye had eaten one of his own, as if a hand slid around his neck. Charles gave a stifled cry and felt his heart and stomach cram up into his throat. For one terrible moment, he thought he was going to wet himself. It was Kenny Griffin, smiling complacently. "Miss Bird sent me after you because you've been gone 6 years. You're in trouble." "Yeah, but I can't go to the basement," Charles said, feeling faint with the fright Kenny had given him. "You're constipated," Kenny chortled gleefully. "Wait till I tell Kathy."
"You better not," Charles said urgently. "Besides, I'm not. There's a tiger in there."
"What's he doing?" Kenny asked. "Taking a piss?"
"I don't know," Charles said, turning his face to the wall. "I just wish he'd go away." He began to weep.
"Hey," Kenny said, bewildered and a little frightened.
"Hey, what if I have to go? What if I can't help it? Miss Bird'll say..."
"Come on," Kenny said, grabbing his arm in one hand and pushing the door open with the other. "You're making it up." They were inside before Charles, terrified, could break free and cower back against the door. "Tiger," Kenny said disgustedly. "Boy, Miss Bird's gonna kill you."
"It's around the other side."
Kenny began to walk past the washbowls.
"Kitty, kitty, kitty. Kitty."
"Don't," Charles hissed. Kenny disappeared around the corner.
"Kitty, kitty. Kitty, kitty, kit."
Charles darted out the door again and pressed himself against the wall, waiting, his hands over his mouth and his eyes squint shut, waiting, waiting for the scream. There was no scream. He had no idea how long he stood there, frozen, his bladder bursting. He looked at the door to the boys' basement. It told him nothing. It was just a door. He wouldn't. He couldn't. But at last he went in. The washbowls and the mirrors were neat, and the faint smell of chlorine was unchanged. But there seemed to be a smell under it, a faint, unpleasant smell, like freshly sheared copper. With groaning but silent trepidation, he went to the corner of the L and peeped around. The tiger was sprawled on the floor, licking its large paws with a long, pink tongue. It looked incuriously at Charles. There was a torn piece of shirt caught in one set of claws. But his need was a white agony now, and he couldn't help it. He had to. Charles tiptoed back to the white porcelain basin closest to the door. Miss Bird slammed in just as he was zipping his pants.
"Why, you dirty, filthy little boy," she said, almost reflectively.
Charles was keeping a weather eye on the corner.
"I'm sorry, Miss Bird. The tiger. I'm going to clean the sink. I'll use soap. I swear I will."
"Where's Kenneth?" Miss Bird asked calmly.
"I don't know."
He didn't, really.
"Is he back there?"
"No," Charles cried. Miss Bird stalked to the place where the room bent.
"Come here, Kenneth, right this moment."
"Miss Bird!" But Miss Bird was already around the corner. She meant to pounce. Charles thought Miss Bird was about to find out what pouncing was really all about. He went out the door again. He got a drink at the drinking fountain. He looked at the American flag hanging over the entrance to the gym. He looked at the bulletin board. Woodsy Owl said, "Give a hoot, don't pollute." Officer Friendly said, "Never ride with strangers." Charles read everything twice. Then he went back to the classroom, walked down his road to his seat with his eyes on the floor, and slid into his seat. It was 10:45. He took out Roads to Everywhere and began to read about Bill at the Rodeo.
The Monkey, read by Matthew Broderick.
When Hal Shelburne saw it, when his son Dennis pulled it out of a moldering Ralston Purina carton that had been pushed far back under one attic eave, such a feeling of horror and dismay rose in him that for one moment he thought he would scream. He put one fist to his mouth as if to cram it back and then merely coughed into his fist. Neither Terry nor Dennis noticed, but Petey looked around, momentarily curious. "Hey, neat," Dennis said respectfully. It was a tone Hal rarely got from the boy anymore himself. Dennis was 12. "What is it?" Peter asked. He glanced at his father again before his eyes were dragged back to the thing his big brother had found. "What is it, Daddy?" "It's a monkey, Fart Brains," Dennis said. "Haven't you ever seen a monkey before?" "Don't call your brother Fart Brains," Terry said automatically, and began to examine a box of curtains. The curtains were slimy with mildew, and she dropped them quickly. "Ugh." "Can I have it, Daddy?" Petey asked. He was 9. "What do you mean?" Dennis cried. "I found it." "Boys, please," Terry said. "I'm getting a headache." Hal barely heard them. The monkey glimmered up at him from his older son's hands, grinning its old familiar grin. The same grin that had haunted his nightmares as a kid. Haunted them until he had... Outside, a cold gust of wind rose, and for a moment lips with no flesh blew a long note through the old rusty gutter outside. Petey stepped closer to his father, eyes moving uneasily to the rough attic roof through which nailheads poked. "What was that, Daddy?" he asked as the whistle died to a guttural buzz. "Just the wind," Hal said, still looking at the monkey. Its symbols, crescents of brass rather than full circles in the weak light of one naked bulb, were moveless, perhaps a foot apart, and he added automatically, "Wind can whistle, but it can't carry a tune." Then he realized that was a saying of Uncle Will's, and a goose ran over his grave. The note came again, the wind coming off Crystal Lake in a long, droning swoop, and then wavering in the gutter. Half a dozen small drafts puffed cold October air into Hal's face. God, this place was so much like the back closet of the house in Hartford that they might all have been transported 30 years back in time. "I won't think about that." But now, of course, it was all he could think about. In the back closet where I found that goddamn monkey in the same box. Terry had moved away to examine a wooden crate filled with knick-knacks, duck-walking because the pitch of the eaves was so sharp. "I don't like it," Petey said, and felt for Hal's hand. "Dennis can have it if he wants. Can we go, Daddy?" "Worried about ghost chicken guts?" Dennis inquired. "Dennis, you stop it," Terry said absently. She picked up a wafer-thin cup with a Chinese pattern. "This is nice. This..." Hal saw that Dennis had found the wind-up key in the monkey's back. Terra flew through him on dark wings. "Don't do that!" It came out more sharply than he had intended, and he had snatched the monkey out of Dennis's hands before he was really aware he had done it. Dennis looked around at him, startled. Terry had also glanced back over her shoulder, and Petey looked up. For a moment they were all silent, and the wind whistled again, very low this time, like an unpleasant invitation. "I mean, it's probably broken," Hal said. "It used to be broken, except when it wanted not to be." "Well, you didn't have to grab," Dennis said. "Dennis, shut up." Dennis blinked and for a moment looked almost uneasy. Hal hadn't spoken to him so sharply in a long time, not since he had lost his job with National Aerodyne in California 2 years before, and they had moved to Texas. Dennis decided not to push it, for now. He turned back to the Ralston Purina cart and began to root through it again. But the other stuff was nothing but junk. Broken toys, bleeding springs, and stuffings. The wind was louder now, hooting instead of whistling. The attic began to creak softly, making a noise like footsteps. "Please, Daddy?" Petey asked, only loud enough for his father to hear. "Yeah," he said. "Terry, let's go." "I'm not through with this. I said let's go." It was her turn to look startled. They had taken 2 adjoining rooms in a motel. By 10 that night, the boys were asleep in their room, and Terry was asleep in the adults' room. She had taken 2 volumes in the ride back from the home place in Casco to keep her nerves from giving her a migraine. Just lately, she took a lot of Valium. It had started around the time National Aerodyne had laid Hal off. For the last 2 years, he had been working for Texas Instruments. It was $4,000 less a year, but it was work. He told Terry they were lucky. She agreed. There were plenty of software architects drawing unemployment, he said. She agreed. The company housing in Arnett was every bit as good as the place in Fresno, he said. She agreed, but he thought her agreement to all of it was a lie. And he was losing Dennis. He could feel the kid going, achieving a premature escape velocity. So long, Dennis. Bye-bye, stranger. It was nice sharing this train with you. Terry said she thought the boy was smoking reefer. She smelled it sometimes. You have to talk to him, Hal. And he agreed, but so far he had not. The boys were asleep. Terry was asleep. Hal went into the bathroom and locked the door and sat down on the closed lid of the John and looked at the monkey. He hated the way it felt. That soft, brown, nappy fur, worn bald in spots. He hated its grin. That monkey grins just like a nigger, Uncle Will had said once. But it didn't grin like a nigger or anything human. Its grin was all teeth. And if you wound up the key, the lips would move, the teeth would seem to get bigger, to become vampire teeth. The lips would writhe and the cymbals would bang, stupid monkey. Stupid clockwork monkey, stupid, stupid. He dropped it. His hands were shaking and he dropped it. The key clicked on the bathroom tile as it struck the floor. The sound seemed very loud in the stillness. It grinned at him with its murky amber eyes, doll's eyes filled with idiot glee, its brass cymbals poised as if to strike up a march for some band from hell. On the bottom, the words "Made in Hong Kong" were stamped. "You can't be here," he whispered. "I threw you down the well when I was 9. The monkey grinned up at him. Outside in the night, a black cap full of wind shook the motel. Hal's brother Bill and Bill's wife Colette met them at Uncle Will's and Aunt Ida's the next day. "Did it ever cross your mind that a death in the family is a really lousy way to renew the family connection?" Bill asked him with a bit of a grin. He had been named for Uncle Will. "Will and Bill, champions of the rodeo," Uncle Will used to say and ruffle Bill's hair. It was one of his sayings. Like the wind can whistle, but it can't carry a tune. Uncle Will had died 6 years before, and Aunt Ida had lived on here alone, until a stroke had taken her just the previous week. "Very sudden," Bill had said when he called long distance to give Hal the news, as if he could know, as if anyone could know. She had died alone. "Yeah," Hal said. "The thought crossed my mind." They looked at the place together, the home place where they had finished growing up. Their father, a merchant mariner, had simply disappeared, as if from the very face of the earth when they were young. Bill claimed to remember him vaguely, but Hal had no memories of him at all. Their mother had died when Bill was 10 and Hal 8. Aunt Ida had brought them here on a Greyhound bus, which left from Hartford, and they had been raised here and gone to college from here. This had been the place they were homesick for. Bill had stayed in Maine and now had a healthy law practice in Portland. Hal saw that Petey had wandered off toward the blackberry tangles that lay on the eastern side of the house in a mad jumble. "Stay away from there, Petey," he called. Petey looked back, questioning. Hal felt simple love for the boy rush him, and he suddenly thought of the monkey again. "Why, Dad?" "The old well's back there someplace," Bill said. "But I'll be damned if I remember just where." "Your dad's right, Petey. It's a good place to stay away from. Thorns will do a job on you, right, Hal?" "Right," Hal said automatically. Petey moved away, not looking back, and then started down the embankment toward the small shingle of beach where Dennis was skipping stones over the water. Hal felt something in his chest loosen a little. Bill might have forgotten where the old well was, but late that afternoon Hal went to it unerringly, shouldering his way through the brambles that tore at his old flannel jacket, and hunted for his eyes. He reached it and stood there, breathing hard, looking at the rotted, warped boards that covered it. After a moment's debate, he knelt, his knees fired twin pistol shots, and moved two of the boards aside. From the bottom of that wet, rock-lined throat, a drowning face stared up at him, wide eyes, grimacing mouth. A moan escaped him. It was not loud, except in his heart. There it had been very loud. It was his own face in the dark water. Not the monkeys. For a moment he had thought it was the monkeys. He was shaking, shaking all over. I threw it down the well, I threw it down the well. Please, God, don't let me be crazy, I threw it down the well. The well had gone dry the summer Johnny McCabe died, the year after Bill and Hal came to stay with Uncle Will and Aunt Ida. Uncle Will had borrowed money from the bank to have an artesian well sunk, and the blackberry tangles had grown up around the old dug well, the dry well. Except the water had come back, like the monkey. This time the memory could not be denied. Hal sat there helplessly letting it come, trying to go with it, to ride it like a surfer riding a monster wave that will crush him if he falls off his board. Just trying to get through it so it would be gone again. He had crept out here with a monkey late that summer, and the blackberries had been out, the smell of them thick and clawing. No one came in here to pick, although Aunt Ida would sometimes stand at the edge of the tangles and pick a cupful of berries into her apron. In here the blackberries had gone past ripe to overripe. Some of them were rotting, sweating a thick white fluid like pus, and the crickets sang maddeningly in the high grass underfoot, their endless cry, "Ree-ee-ee-ee." The thorns tore at him, brought dots of blood onto his cheeks and bare arms. He made no effort to avoid their sting. He had been blind with terror, so blind that he had come within inches of stumbling onto the rotten boards that covered the well, perhaps within inches of crashing 30 feet to the well's muddy bottom. He had pinwheeled his arms for balance, and more thorns had branded his forearms. It was that memory that had caused him to call Petey back sharply. That was the day Johnny McCabe died, his best friend. Johnny had been climbing the rungs up to his treehouse in his backyard. The two of them had spent many hours up there that summer, playing pirate, seeing make-believe galleons out on the lake, unlimbering the cannons, reefing the stunsel, whatever that was, preparing to board. Johnny had been climbing up to the treehouse, as he had done 1,000 times before, and the rung just below the trap door in the bottom of the treehouse had snapped off in his hands, and Johnny had fallen 30 feet to the ground and had broken his neck, and it was the monkey's fault. The monkey. The goddamn hateful monkey. When the phone rang, when Aunt Ida's mouth dropped open and then formed an O of horror as her friend Millie from down the road told her the news, when Aunt Ida said, "Come out on the porch, Hal. I have to tell you some bad news," he had thought with sick horror. The monkey. What's the monkey done now? There had been no reflection of his face trapped at the bottom of the well the day he threw the monkey down. Only stone cobbles and the stink of wet mud. He had looked at the monkey lying there on the wiry grass that grew between the blackberry tangles, its cymbals poised, its grinning teeth huge between its splayed lips, its fur rubbed away in balding, mangy patches here and there. Its glazed eyes. "I hate you," he hissed at it. He wrapped his hand around the loathsome body, feeling the nappy fur crinkle. It grinned at him as he held it up in front of his face. "Go on," he dared it, beginning to cry for the first time that day. He shook it. The poised cymbals trembled minutely. The monkey spoiled everything good, everything. "Go on, clap them, clap them." The monkey only grinned. "Go on and clap them." His voice rose hysterically. "Fraidy cat, fraidy cat, go on and clap them, I dare you, double dare you." Its brownish yellow eyes, its huge gleeful teeth. He threw it down the well then, mad with grief and terror. He saw it turn over once on its way down, a simian acrobat doing a trick, and the sun glinted one last time on those cymbals. It struck the bottom with a thud. And that must have jogged its clockwork, for suddenly the cymbals did begin to beat. Their steady, deliberate, and tinny banging rose to his ears, echoing in fay in the stone throat of the dead well. Jang, 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 jang. Hal clapped his hands over his mouth, and for a moment he could see it down there, perhaps only in the eye of imagination. Lying there in the mud, eyes glaring up at the small circle of his boy's face, peering over the lip of the well, as if marking that face forever, lips expanding and contracting around those grinning teeth, cymbals clapping, funny wind-up monkey. Jang, 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 jang. Who's dead? Jang, 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 jang. Is it Johnny McCabe? Falling with his eyes wide, doing his own acrobatic somersault, as he falls through the bright summer vacation air, with the splintered rung still held in his hands, to strike the ground with a single bitter snapping sound, with blood flying out of his nose and mouth and wide eyes? Is it Johnny, Hal? Or is it you? Moaning, Hal shoved the boards across the hole, getting splinters in his hands, not caring, not even aware of them until later. And still he could hear it, even through the boards, muffled now, and somehow all the worse for that. It was down there in stone-faced dark, clapping its cymbals and jerking its repulsive body, the sound coming up like sounds heard in a dream. Jang, 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 jang. Who's dead this time? He fought and battered his way back through the blackberry creepers. Thorns stitched fresh lines of welling blood briskly across his face, and burdocks caught in the cuffs of his jeans, and he fell full length once, his ear still jangling as if it had followed him. Uncle Will found him later, sitting on an old tire in the garage and sobbing, and he had thought Hal was crying for his dead friend. So he had been. But he had also cried in the aftermath of terror. He had thrown the monkey down the well in the afternoon. That evening, as twilight crept in through a shimmering mantle of ground fog, a car moving too fast for the reduced visibility had run down Aunt Ida's Manx cat in the road and gone right on. There had been guts everywhere. Bill had thrown up. But Hal had only turned his face away, his pale, still face. Hearing Aunt Ida's sobbing, this on top of the news about the McCabe boy had caused a fit of weeping that was almost hysterics. It was almost 2 hours before Uncle Will could calm her completely, as if from miles away. In his heart there was a cold and exultant joy. It hadn't been his turn. It had been Aunt Ida's Manx, not him, not his brother Bill or his Uncle Will, just two champions of the rodeo. And now the monkey was gone. It was down the well, and one scruffy Manx cat with ear mites was not too great a price to pay. If the monkey wanted to clap its hellish cymbals now, let it. It could clap and clash them for the crawling bugs and beetles, the dark things that made their home in the well's stone gullet. It would rot down there. Its loathsome cogs and wheels and springs would rust down there. It would die down there, in the mud and the darkness. Spiders would spin it a shroud. But it had come back. Slowly, Hal covered the well again, as he had on that day, and in his ears he heard the phantom echo of the monkey cymbals. Jang, 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 jang. Who's dead, Hal? Is it Terry? Dennis? Is it Petey, Hal? He's your favorite, isn't he? Is it him? Jang, jang, jang. Put that down. Petey flinched and dropped the monkey. And for one nightmare moment, Hal thought that that would do it, that the jolt would jog its machinery and the cymbals would begin to beat and clash. Daddy, you scared me. I'm sorry, I don't want you to play with that. The others had gone to see a movie, and he had thought he would beat them back to the motel. But he had stayed at the home place longer than he would have guessed. The old hateful memories seemed to move in their own eternal time zone. Terry was sitting near Dennis, watching the Beverly Hillbillies. She watched the old grainy print with a steady, bemused concentration that spoke of a recent volume pop. Dennis was reading a rock magazine with Culture Club on the cover. Petey had been sitting cross-legged on the carpet, goofing with the monkey. "Doesn't work anyway," Petey said. Which explains why Dennis let him have it, Hal thought. And then felt ashamed and angry at himself. He felt this uncontrollable hostility toward Dennis more and more often. But in the aftermath, he felt demeaned and tacky, helpless. "No," he said, It's old, I'm gonna throw it away. Give it to me. He held out his hand, and Peter, looking troubled, handed it over. Dennis said to his mother, Pop's turning into a friggin' schizophrenic. Hal was across the room even before he knew he was going, the monkey in one hand, grinning as if in approbation. He hauled Dennis out of his chair by the shirt. There was a purring sound as a seam came adrift somewhere. Dennis looked almost comically shocked. His copy of Rockaway fell to the floor. Hey! You come with me, Hal said grimly, pulling his son toward the door to the connecting room. Hal! Terry nearly screamed. Petey just goggled. Hal pulled Dennis through. He slammed the door and then slammed Dennis against the door. Dennis was starting to look scared. You're getting a mouth problem, Hal said. Let go of me, you tore my shirt, you... Hal slammed the boy against the door again. Yes, he said, a real mouth problem. Did you learn that in school or back in the smoking area? Dennis flushed, his face momentarily ugly with guilt. I wouldn't be in that shitty school if you didn't get canned, he burst out. Hal slammed Dennis against the door again. I didn't get canned, I got laid off. You know it, and I don't need any of your shit about it. You have problems, welcome to the world, Dennis. Just don't lay all of them off on me. You're eating, your ass is covered. You are 12 years old, and at 12, I don't need any shit from you. He punctuated each phrase by pulling the boy forward until their noses were almost touching, and then slamming Dennis back into the door. It was not hard enough to hurt, but Dennis was scared. His father had not laid a hand on him since they moved to Texas, and now he began to cry, with the young boy's loud, braying, healthy sobs. Go ahead, beat me up, he yelled at Hal, his face twisted and blotchy. Beat me up if you want. I know how much you fucking hate me. I don't hate you. I love you a lot, Dennis, but I'm your dad, and you're gonna show me respect, or I'm gonna bust you for it. Dennis tried to pull away. Hal pulled the boy to him and hugged him. Dennis fought for a moment, and then put his face against Hal's chest and wept, as if exhausted. It was the sort of cry Hal hadn't heard from either of his children in years. He closed his eyes, realizing that he felt exhausted himself. Terry began to hammer on the other side of the door. Stop it, Hal! Whatever you're doing to him, stop it! I'm not killing him, Hal said. Go away, Terry. Don't you? It's all right, Mom, Dennis said, muffled against Hal's chest. He could feel her perplexed silence for a moment, and then she went. Hal looked at his son again. Sorry I bad-mouthed you, Dad, Dennis said reluctantly. Okay, I accept that with thanks. When we get home next week, I'm gonna wait 2 or 3 days, and then I'm gonna go through all your drawers, Dennis. If there's something in them you don't want me to see, you better get rid of it. That flash of guilt again. Dennis lowered his eyes and wiped away snot with the back of his hand. Can I go now? He sounded sullen once more. Sure, Hal said, and let him go. Got to take him camping in the spring, just the two of us, do some fishing. Like Uncle Will used to do with Bill and me. Gotta get close to him, gotta try. He sat down on the bed in the empty room and looked at the monkey. You'll never be close to him again, Hal, its grin seemed to say. Count on it. I am back to take care of business, just like you always knew I would be, someday. Hal laid the monkey aside and put a hand over his eyes. That night, Hal stood in the bathroom brushing his teeth and thought, it was in the same box. How could it be in the same box? The toothbrush jabbed upward, hurting his gums. He winced. He had been 4, Bill 6, the first time he saw the monkey. Their missing father had bought a house in Hartford, and it had been theirs, free and clear, before he died, or fell into a hole in the middle of the world, or whatever it had been. Their mother worked as a secretary at Holmes Aircraft, the helicopter plant out in Westville, and a series of sitters came in to stay with the boys. Except by then it was just Hal that the sitters had to mind through the day. Bill was in first grade, big school. None of the babysitters stayed for long. They got pregnant and married their boyfriends, or got work at Holmes. Or Mrs. Shelburne would discover that they had been at the cooking sherry, or her bottle of brandy, which was kept in a sideboard for special occasions. Most were stupid girls, who seemed only to want to eat or sleep. None of them wanted to read to Hal, as his mother would do. The sitter that long winter was a huge, sleek black girl named Beulah. She fawned over Hal when Hal's mother was around, and sometimes pinched him when she wasn't. Still, Hal had some liking for Beulah, who once in a while would read him a lurid tale from one of her Confession or True Detective magazines. "Death came for the voluptuous redhead," Beulah would intone ominously in the dozy daytime silence of the living room, and pop another Reese's peanut butter cup into her mouth, while Hal solemnly studied the grainy tabloid pictures and drank milk from his wish cup. The liking made what happened worse. He found the monkey on a cold, cloudy day in March. Sleet ticked sporadically off the windows, and Beulah was asleep on the couch, a copy of My Story tented open on her admirable bosom. Hal had crept into the back closet to look at his father's things. The back closet was a storage space that ran the length of the second floor on the left side, extra space that had never been finished off. You got into it by using a small door, a down-the-rabbit-hole sort of door, on Bill's side of the boys' bedroom. They both liked to go in there, even though it was chilly in winter, and hot enough in summer to wring a bucketful of sweat out of your pores. Long and narrow and somehow snug, the back closet was full of fascinating junk. No matter how much stuff you looked at, you never seemed to be able to look at it all. He and Bill had spent whole Saturday afternoons up there, barely speaking to each other, taking things out of boxes, examining them, turning them over and over so their hands could absorb each unique reality, putting them back. Now Hal wondered if he and Bill hadn't been trying as best they could to somehow make contact with their vanished father. He had been a merchant mariner with a navigator certificate, and there were stacks of charts in the closet, some marked with neat circles and the dimple of the compass's swing point in the center of each. There were 20 volumes of something called Baron's Guide to Navigation, a set of cockeyed binoculars that made your eyes feel hot and funny if you looked through them too long. There were touristy things from a dozen ports of call, rubber hula-hula dolls, a black cardboard bowler with a torn band that said, "You pick a girl and I'll pick a dilly." A glass globe with a tiny Eiffel Tower inside. There were envelopes with foreign stamps tucked carefully away inside, and foreign coins. There were rock samples from the Hawaiian Islands of Maui, a glassy black, heavy and somehow ominous, and funny records in foreign languages. That day, with the sleet ticking hypnotically off the roof just above his head, Hal worked his way all the way down to the far end of the back closet, moved a box aside, and saw another box behind it, a Ralston Purina box. Looking over the top was a pair of glassy hazel eyes. They gave him a start, and he skittered back for a moment, heart thumping, as if he discovered a deadly pygmy. Then he saw its silence, the glaze in those eyes, and realized it was some sort of toy. He moved forward again and lifted it carefully from the box. It grinned its ageless, toothy grin in the yellow light, its symbols held apart. Delighted, Hal had turned it this way and that, feeling the crinkle of its nappy fur. Its funny grin pleased him. Yet hadn't there been something else? An almost instinctive feeling of disgust that had come and gone almost before he was aware of it. Perhaps it was so, but with an old, old memory like this one, you had to be careful not to believe too much. Old memories could lie. But hadn't he seen the same expression on Petey's face in the attic of the home place? He had seen the key set into the small of its back and turned it. It had turned far too easily. There were no winding up clicks. Broken then, broken but still neat. He took it out to play with it. "What you got, Hal?" Beulah asked, waking from her nap. "Nothing," Hal said. "I found it." He put it up on the shelf on his side of the bedroom. It stood atop his lassie coloring books, grinning, staring into space, symbols poised.